This is the Medic Cast, recorded back on October 13th as the Medic Cast Live, but you're hearing it now here on the Medic Cast, October 19th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we're going to move right on into our special episode here in just a sec. On ultrasound, we had Brian Dunnigan, a paramedic from the state of Maine and formerly in the state of New York, joining us, as well as Dr. Eric Brader, and they were talking about the uses and applications of ultrasound technology for assessment and diagnosis in the EMS setting. So before we jump into that, I want to remind you, you'll find links to some of the things we've been talking about in this episode coming up over at medicast.com/blog. You'll also find links and other information if you want to check out the information over at medicastlive.com, as well as upcoming episodes that you'll be finding there. And I want to remind you that if you want to get back in touch with me, send me an email to podmedic@mac.com, or you can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. We'll get you through to the MedicCast voicemail line. I also want to remind you, you'll find me over at facebook.com/podmedic and over at twitter.com/podmedic if you want to catch up with me in those other locations. And don't worry, we'll be back again next week with a regular tip of the week episode. And all of those tips are important for a lot of you because you like to follow up on these things and for those of you that are students as well. So let's jump on in right now to the recorded session from this past Tuesday night on the MedicCast Live, where we were talking about EMS ultrasound. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and you're listening to a special recording of the MedicCast Live. We're going to be talking about ultrasound as a field piece of equipment for us to use as a diagnostic tool, as an assessment tool to help us prepare to treat our patients better and get them to the correct facility depending on what's going on. And I always joke with my patients about I don't have my x-ray vision license yet. And heck, maybe I'll be able to have that once we get some ultrasound in the units. So without further ado, let's jump on into the show. I want to introduce our special guests. First off, we have Dr. Eric Brader. Dr. Brader, welcome to the show and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an emergency physician, practice at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. Been involved with EMS for a good 20 years. Did residency in emergency medicine, I'm out 23 years now. But I was one of the original emergency physicians in the United States to use ultrasound in the emergency department. And, I guess back then there was a lot more knobology and that sort of thing, and it was difficult for emergency physicians to do such. But to be honest, I recognize the utility back then, because what I tell my residents now is why guess when you can peek? And ultrasound lets you have a non-invasive peek into what's going on inside your patient. And as the price of units have come down and the ease of use have come down, it just makes it easier to bring into everyday practice, and not only for physicians, as more and more physicians are using ultrasound for various diagnosing various conditions at point of care, but it also makes sense, in my opinion, that we need to start doing it in the field and helping us, particularly in conditions where guessing may not be the best way to go about things and take a peek and better define and better strategize on the best way to treat patients.
I think that's true, and hopefully anything we can do to alleviate some of the concerns people have with getting refusals or taking patients needlessly to a trauma facility at a distance when they could just as well go to a local facility, or erroneously taking them to the local facility when they should have gone to a trauma center, certainly will help us out. I also want to welcome Brian Dunnigan. Some of you may remember Brian joined us back in August and first brought up the subject of ultrasound and EMS. Brian gave me a call out of the blue and said, would I like to talk about it a little bit and maybe do something about it on the show? And I took him up on that and actually talked him into being a guest on the show. We had a great interview, got some good response back from it, and really I wanted to expand this and do a Medicast Live on it to give you all the chance to respond back and ask your questions. Brian, tell us a little bit about your background and where you stand on using ultrasound and EMS.
Well, let's see, I've been in EMS since 1980 and went to paramedic school out in California and got involved in ultrasound. I think I met Dr. Brader approximately 2 years ago, just on a brainstorm of trying to develop a cost-effective portable ultrasound device with good image quality. And like Dr. Brader had suggested, less knobology without all the knobs. And he and I kind of got together and been collaborating about ultrasound and EMS for almost 2 years, would you say, Dr. Brader?
Probably most collaborations probably been about a year. You know, we had some talk earlier, but really things didn't start to get rolling until about a year ago.
Yeah, probably a year ago, but I think I touched base with it a little bit before that. But Eric got me actually. Dr. Brader actually got me really interested in ultrasound, and so ever since I've had numerous discussions with him and other people in the industry, I'm a total believer in ultrasound, and more of my knowledge is more didactic and pretty much what most people probably have gotten out there, what's on the web, than actual clinical use. Dr. Brader's a clinical expert in ultrasound, and I'm more of a EMS passionate enthusiast about trying to open up the doors and see if ultrasound can be accomplished in getting into ground-based and aeromedical EMS. Is that a good answer, Gene?
That's an excellent answer, actually. I always like to let people know where we're coming from, because so often I think we don't realize that we all really have a lot of the same training and the same backgrounds in many cases, and it's usually just a chance encounter like you seem to have had with Dr. Brader that really made a difference in a direction in which you found yourself going. And so I'd like to, you know, really follow up on that and get into the meat of this discussion right now. And I don't know which of you'd like to go first. I guess we'll start with Dr. Brader. This has been not really a new idea, and I was surprised by that because I hadn't really heard much about it, but I found some articles going back to 2003 talking about a study, a pilot program in Texas using ultrasounds in the units and the success they've had. So, and of course, other countries around the world are using ultrasounds in their units in various stages of the care process. What is your feeling about this in the United States? Is it really that new, or is it something we just are slow to adopt?
Well, I think it's been the barrier, one, of price, two, affordability, and three, ultrasound is much more widely practiced in Europe, and it's because there are actually in several countries in Europe, there's more docs who go out and are doing actual, you know, scene response work. Now, a lot of the countries are not even emergency physicians. Some of the, you know, there's dermatologists and stuff that are floating around in like response vehicles, like in France. And but they have some ultrasound background, so they're actually, you know, some of this work's being done there. and just some general uses of ultrasound vary in Europe. And so the main focus in the United States has been with trauma and what's called a FAST exam and looking for internal bleeding. And that's of some value and was the original focus for doing ultrasound and figuring out which patients, helping figure out which patients need to go to the trauma center. But there's a whole host of other conditions and situations that that ultrasound could be a value in your decision making, and in a lot of medical conditions too. So it's not just trauma. So you know, if and it's the more you do it, the better you get at it, the more things you're able to pick up on. And you know, trauma is just the tip of the iceberg. And I think what should I say, the initial costs were prohibitive, but with the ease of use of the machines, the portability, the decrease in cost, and the more and more applications that you're able to use, then it makes sense. Well, you know, instead of having this expensive device for you know, that trauma patient that you might see, you know, you can use it in a number of other situations other than the original focus for just trauma.
So, you know, we're looking at, obviously, the first thing that leapt to my mind was trauma. And as you said, that seems to be the initial thought process here in the States. But you say there are other uses for medical patients. So what specific, can you give us a couple of examples of where we might have a common patient transport situation where ultrasound would be useful to help us determine a treatment, course of treatment for our patients?
One of my favorites currently, for a while, that's not really publicized, but will become more widely practiced, is with modern ultrasounds that have a lot of image cleanup and focusing techniques that older machines didn't have. You can actually see patients' lungs now. Before, you know, sonologists and radiologists would say you can't look at lungs with ultrasound. Well, you can actually look at lungs with ultrasound now, and the reason why that's important is if you have a shortness of breath patient, one, it's very easy to see a pneumothorax, but two, you can also see congestive heart failure on ultrasound. You can see a phenomenon known as comet tailing in someone's lungs. So if you have that shortness of breath patient, you know, they've got a history of COPD, they've got a history of CHF, you know, they've got some swelling in their legs, but they've always got swelling in their legs, and you're having some trouble sorting them out. You know, they may not be doing a lot of wheezing. And so in the COPD patient, if you, for instance, give them Lasix and diuresum, that's been shown to increase mortality in COPD patients. So if you give a COPD patient Lasix by mistake over large numbers of patients, you'll actually hurt a couple of them. So you can actually put this up to someone's chest and with a minimum of training, look at their lung fields and see whether they're wet or not.
That's, you know, that's something I hadn't really thought about, because I still, you know, I don't know. I think ultrasound, I guess because my wife's had three kids, I think ultrasound,
yeah.
I think abdominal cavity. But you point out, you know, there are several medical uses just in the thorax. What else? I guess we could also use this for looking at patients that are pregnant and looking at a potential viability of is the fetus still alive? Those kind of questions can be answered as well, I guess.
Absolutely. Fetal compromise. You can see the fetal heart movement, and without too much knobology, you can get the ultrasound to actually count the fetal heart rate. So you can, you know, verify what's going on in the uterus, so to speak. You know, getting back to the chest too, with regard to trauma patients, a lot of the trauma indications have been abdominal, but you know, particularly, and I see this as for flight medicine, and what's one of the things we're going to do with our program here is there's no one in the world who can hear breath sounds in a helicopter. I don't believe anyone who thinks that, you know, who can determine one, whether they're hearing breath sounds, and two, can determine whether who's got a pneumothorax and helicopter. And, you know, someone who's had a chest wall injury, you can put the ultrasound on them and look and see if they have a pneumothorax. And the reason why that's important is, and also in the field too, it can be very difficult to determine these patients. But if you're in a situation where you can't hear at all in the helicopter, your patient starts crashing, you're going to debate whether to needle their chest or not. And in my mind, and I've flown in the helicopters earlier in my career, you're just guessing. And, you know, why guess when you can peek? And you can look and see that pneumothorax and feel a lot easier about decompressing the lung and decompressing the correct lung, because sometimes it's not the one that you're going to guess that's got the tension. And you can watch the needle go right into the cavity where you want it to, right on the ultrasound. So not only do you pick out your patient correctly, but you can verify that you didn't place your catheter subcutaneously and that it's sitting down in the pleural space where you want to. You can also see pulmonary contusions developing with the modern ultrasound. So your sats may be dropping out, but you can look at the chest. You know, you can see the lungs are still inflated, and you can see the effect of the pulmonary contusion on the image of the lung. So you now have a reason, instead of, once again, somebody's getting pulmonary contusions, their sats are dropping, do I need to needle this guy? In the helicopter in particular, and you can look, see, well, their lungs are up, and this guy's getting a contusion, that's why his sats are dropping down. And the last thing we want to do is stick a needle in a fully inflated lung and now give him a pneumothorax on top of a pulmonary contusion and compromises his respirations even further. So so that is a trauma, but it's a non-typical use at present, but I think it's one of the easiest applications to bring in, and it'll markedly change practice, I think, in flight medicine. And, you know, we're just getting started with it with our program here, but it makes such a difference in just that one particular situation that you can properly, more easily do a proper procedure, one, and two, avoid doing a potentially injurious procedure in patients where it's not indicated.
Brian, you said that the military has been using ultrasounds quite a bit and found a lot of success with it. Would you like to share a little bit about what you've talked to people about?
Well, they're using it. One of the studies they did, and it was somewhere between 5 and 7 years ago, that they were able to decrease door-to-surgery times by taking two sets of patients, subset A and B. And so basically the medics were using ultrasound on their patients in the field, positive fast findings with hypotension, went directly to the OR surgical suite with a 98.9% positive finding once they opened them up, instead of having to do DPL, diagnostic peritoneal lavage, which takes more time. And then they took the other subset of patients, subset B, and those that were normotensive patients went to CT perfusion, and their results actually were the same, 98%, 99%. So basically, being able to decrease door-to-surgical times in the field for the military, or if you even were to correlate a similar study for us, which Hennepin County EMS, Dr. William Hegard sent me his abstract, which he sent in for peer review to AEM, which is American Emergency Medicine Journal, I believe. I believe he had a 42-year-old male stabbed in the left ventricle and was conscious, but his vital signs were really bad on the abstract. I think I sent a copy of it to you, Dr. Brader, as well, and I think you may have it, Jamie. It took 9 minutes for the ambulance to get to the call, the scene of the call, two paramedics, a ground-based ambulance, and they took a quick look with ultrasound at the heart, and they noticed a big pericardial infusion, which was probably echogenic fluid. And the ETA back to the hospital was 7 minutes. So now we're talking about 15 minutes of 7 and 9 is 15, I think, if I can add, 16. And so they took him directly from the back of the ambulance right to the operating room suite, the operating room theater. And they did a sternectomy, and they sewed up his left ventricle. And then the patient left 4 days later with no neurological sequelae, completely intact, which, to me, that just demonstrates that whatever happens in the military for EMS, which mask pants were used 90 years ago with them, whatever, their studies actually can probably correlate or turn over to us in the civilian world of EMS and probably make things better for us. Because obviously they have the money in the tax base to support that type of equipment, whereas EMS here in the United States, we're so fragmented between different EMS agencies. Who is going to decide how, what, where, and why they're going to pay for an ultrasound unit and what advantages it's going to have?
I had a question in the chat room real quick. What's the cost of one of these units to put on an ambulance? Is it something that's a significant expense? You said earlier that the cost was one of the things that was helping to keep it out of units.
Yeah, it depends where you want to go with and how much functionality you want to have in your unit. There's you can probably do something reasonable. There's some that are a couple thousand that I don't think are quite. I don't think there's quite enough horse there, so to speak. There are fragile ones that if you drop it, you own it, and that's. They're not hardened. And then, we've been looking at developing a field one and have a good prototype at this point that is fully functional and will be able to do anything that you want to do as you come along. And that's going to run about $20,000, probably a little over that at this point. But that'd be a hardened unit that would be very multifunctional and have a lot of... even have some non-ultrasound capabilities built into it, like having trip sheet programs built into it that would automatically integrate your images with your trip sheet. As far as keeping medical records, that's going to be important as going forward that you document your images. So you better, at that price, you better be using it frequently, and it needs to make a difference in your practice, and that will need to be seen. But going forward, I think as these sort of devices, I think, become more commonplace and you're able to make better, more and better decisions with them, that your prices will end up starting coming down just like any other sort of technology, but at this point, that's what you're looking at. But it can gauge a lot of different things with your patients. One of the things I like to do with it is if you have a hypotensive patient come in and you're not sure, are they hypovolemic, is it cardiac in nature, you can look at, and there's recently been some more data published on this, is it's relatively easy to look at someone's inferior vena cava while they're laying on their back. Obviously, if they're hypotensive, generally they're going to be laying down for you. And you can look at that right away and tell whether they're hypovolemic or not. And obviously, if they're hypovolemic, they need fluids. If they don't look hypovolemic, you can take a quick and dirty look at their heart. And it's very easy to tell heart that's not squeezing the way it should be, doing fine sort of things and looking at subtleties for hearts. We're not looking for any medic to do that, but if you're looking for, somebody's heart is malfunctioning to the point of having hypotension, it's obvious, what's going on with the heart and why blood's not moving forward when you look at it. And, doing some relatively... It's not terribly difficult to get some quick and dirty looks at the heart and have an idea what's, what's wrong and what's not, what potential problems might be.
Jamie, I wanted to bring another point up. I thought that was actually great what Dr. Breda brought up, because if we can't tell why somebody is hypotensive and they may present to us like it could be a pump problem, and if their IVC is full and we start dumping vasopressors on them, then we're going to start squeezing, putting too much squeeze on the heart, which is another bad thing. So, I mean, if we can start telling if it's a pump problem and how we're going to treat them with potential vasopressors or butamine and dopamine concomitantly, we could definitely start treating the patients more appropriately, because if we start putting vasopressors and start dumping vasopressors on people that are hypovolemic and we start squeezing the heart and there's nothing to squeeze, the outcomes are going to probably be just as bad as doing nothing. I would think the morbidity and mortality would go up significantly.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brian. That some patients, it's obvious. You have a gunshot wound, your chest is going to be hypovolemia. It could be a tension pneumothorax. Obviously, you'll see that on ultrasound and can confirm that. But in your patients, found down, what's going on, you can very much titrate your resuscitation. And if their inferior vena cava looks flat, and you pump it up, and their pressure, you can tell the point where you filled their tank also. So you say, okay, they're topped off. If we try and jam more fluids in this guy, it's going to get wet. So now it's, we've done all we can with their fluids. All we're going to do is harm going forward with more fluids. Let's shift our gears and start working pressors instead of, putting that fourth or fifth liter fluid in someone who's now they're going to get wet and you may have to, worry about tubing someone like this. It's not a difficult thing to do, looking at their inferior vena cava. The other thing you can do in people who are short of breath who are sitting up is you can look at their internal jugular vein, which is even easier to look at. And if your internal jugular vein in a normal person, normal heart, is actually flat when you're sitting up. It's completely drained out of blood. It's there's no fluid backing up in it. And so anyone who's short of breath and their internal jugular vein is not distended doesn't need Lasix. Now, there are some conditions where your lungs can get a little wet and your internal jugular vein doesn't distend, but those conditions are due to pulmonary hypertension not being volume overloaded. So anyone whose IJ isn't dilated up doesn't need Lasix. So you immediately can avoid giving Lasix inappropriately and looking at, giving high-dose nitrates to resolve the pulmonary hypertension, because that's the person who's going to go in a flash pulmonary edema. And a lot of people who go in flash pulmonary edema aren't volume overloaded. Some of them just go in, get acute pulmonary hypertension, and their lungs start getting wet on that basis. It's not because their volume overloaded, and really they need vasodilated rather than diuresed. So you can help differentiate the causes of, shortness of breath and where you should go with looking at it's kind of like using a dipstick on your patient to check their volume status, whether you add more, whether you want to take some off, so to speak. You'll see people who are short of breath who's in general jugular vein, you'll follow it. It'll look like a sewer pipe all the way up to the angle of their mandible. And, usually that person, it's not terribly unobvious that you need to diurese it, someone like that. But if it's a big, heavy person, they tell you their legs are swollen, and you look at their legs, how would you know your legs are swollen? But you can look at their IJ and say, you know what, you are volume overloaded, and getting you started on Lasix is a good idea at this point, particularly getting people started on the right drugs. With in many areas, emergency departments are overloaded, and this patient might not be seen for, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour by a doc, and you can at least get the right drugs started in the meantime to help start getting them turned around.
We had a question in the chat room about the scope of field trials that they've done, or how many services in the United States are currently using ultrasound. Do we have any figures on that?
I would say there's just a handful of clinical trial sites. What would you say, Brian? Maybe four or five?
there was three beta sites that were up and running, but right now, between the three ground-based ambulance systems and Dr. Dave Spears started the first one in Odessa, Texas in year 2000, there's probably about between 10 and 15 helicopter agencies that have ultrasound. I don't know how much they're actually utilizing it. Some people say they are. Some people say they're not using it enough. And that comes back again to education, clinical education and training. So what, you know, that's another caveat with this as well. But, you know, it's definitely being used much more in Europe than it is in the United States. That's for sure.
Yeah. And the, it offers utility. It's going to offer utility too. And, I think in disaster medicine and disaster situations where you can do a lot of things with ultrasound with not a lot of training you can get information that is typically thought of only getting by X-ray. For instance, you can see fractures on ultrasound. Now, if you're in a primitive situation with a disaster and the local hospital's underwater, and you've got more people that can stream through an emergency department, you can screen the bumps and bruises and see who's got non-displaced fractures. Obviously, if someone has, you know, now bending their forearm in a place where there's not to be a joint, then, you know, it's kind of silly to put an ultrasound on them and see, yeah, that's broken. But you can see fractures with ultrasound, and it can help differentiate actually subtle fractures. And has actually more resolution with subtle fractures than X-ray does. Now, the radiologists don't want you to know that. But so, for instance, with the military, you know, you can't be, you know, it's hard to lug an X-ray machine around in the desert and certainly not a CT scanner. So in primitive situations, what you can do is not only use ultrasound to look for intra-abdominal, intra-thoracic injuries, but and they're not doing this yet, to my knowledge, for the military, but you can look for fractures, you can look for retained subcutaneous material. You know, if you get hit with some shrapnel with the military, you're going to be able to look in the soft tissue and see, you know, do you have a retained hunk of metal in there? Did it go through? If it went through, did it leave anything behind? And did you hit any deep structures that you have to be worried about blood vessel-wise? So it really lets you, you can image a wide variety of types of musculoskeletal injuries that's more common to do in Europe than at this point in the United States. I can easily see, a disaster scenario where, you know, that these would be of value to have in the field in lieu of, you know, having X-ray equipment.
Dr. Brader, Jamie, excuse me, I was going to ask Dr. Brader a question. The latest data that I actually was able to pull down was that actually ultrasound is much more reliable than CT or X-ray in the setting for pneumothorax.
Yeah, it's comparable to CT. CT's held as a gold standard, but it's much better than conventional chest X-ray. Conventional chest X-rays miss up to 20-30%, particularly if the patient's lying flat. But with ultrasound, it's pneumothoraces are obvious. It's hard. You can miss a very tiny one that might get picked up on CT. You know, if you just happen to miss a tiny little spot of pneumothorax, it's of inconsequential nature, and the CT machine slices through it because it. You know, you have to direct the ultrasound. The CT just, you know, makes cross-sectional views all the way through the chest. So the CT, once in a while, will pick up a tiny one. The ultrasound will miss, but it's inconsequential. Going back to the chest too, that I like for ultrasound is, you know, that thick-walled person that you intubate and you're bagging them, you know, you can't hear anything. Is the tube really in, or it's that really tight person that you're bagging and, you know, for whatever reason, they got bad COPD, they don't make any breath sounds, you know, is your tube in? Obviously, you have colorimetric methods also, but and for tube verification too. You can squeeze the bag and watch the lung go up and down. If your tube's in place, your lung goes up and down. If it's not in place, your lungs don't go up and down. And you can also gauge whether your tube's too deep, because you can watch, you squeeze the bag. If you've got a right main stem, your left lung doesn't bounce up and down real nice the way your right does when you if you have a right main stem. So you can reassess your tube position very effectively watching the lungs with ultrasound too.
And you can also monitor your ET tube as like they do in anesthesia on those maybe long critical transports or long rides in the back of the bus or the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
In conjunction with capnography, obviously. But, I mean, and one of the things that comes to my mind is recently you hear about paramedics pronouncing people dead, and they say they put the monitor on them, and maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but they're dead. I mean, the ultrasound would actually work a whole lot better for those obviously dead patients than necessarily. I mean, I for medical standards, I would say monitor and ultrasound, but if you were to put the transducer over someone's heart and it's not beating, they're obviously dead. Would you agree, Dr. Brader?
Yeah, if you watch it and there's and it's a more powerful image in case you have one of these ghost patients that somehow managed to make it back to life. They'll just tell you, you didn't put your leads on right. That's why that asystole tracing looks like asystole. You're a moron. You can't tell, you know, a patient that's really dead. Well, you put the ultrasound on them, and you can do a short, recording of the lack of cardiac activity. If the heart's, you know, there's no way that, you know, if you record a clip, you know, and you have a couple second clip, and the heart's just sitting there not doing anything. Well, you know, there's it's hard to say you did it wrong when the heart's just sitting there and not squeezing at all. So that can be helpful for medical legal aspect. I had seen question about transmitting, and that's one of the things we're looking to go forward and build in, you know, with ultrasound. I think it's going to be important early on too, just kind of like with doing 12 lead, being able to transmit it to the receiving facility for verification of what you're seeing out in the field, you know, for instance, cath lab gets activated and that sort of thing, you know, to base treatment on if you're going to base treatment on some of the things you're going to do, there may be, you know, maybe a desire from your medical control, medical command to see some of the stuff you're looking at, or if there's a situation where you're not sure, then being able to transmit, what am I looking at here, doc? What I'm confused or I haven't seen this one before, you know, it. We look at that as being helpful too. And the technology we're looking at would be to be able to transmit it directly to, you know, a particular PC address, like in the emergency department, to a PC that would like be beside the, you know, command radio, command phone, and you know, come up on things and look at things while they're talking to you.
And that's one of the things we didn't really talk about is that Eric and I were talking about the ability, which isn't being done with ultrasound right now, to be able to transmit either the series of images, which would be a cine loop, or just sending one shot, like the money frame shot, which is a picture that we want to send, and send it, you know, via either wide area network or the military or helicopters can use SATCOM. Ground-based ambulances, if they can connect to a wide area or local area network, send it that way. But the other tool that ultrasound would be perfect for us is in terms of EMS providers and doing our M&M or EMS rounds with medical control physicians would be, it's the perfect tool for quality assurance. Are we doing what we're supposed to be doing for our patients? Because we can see an image before. You know if he's got a collapsed lung, so we know that we didn't just empirically pull the needle out of our kit and dart somebody's chest because we either didn't hear breath sounds or they were decreased breath sounds or we got too much wax in our ears. It's an ideal quality assurance tool that changes the way that we treat our patients and potentially changes the way the modality in which we treat our patients, which is what Dr. Braid is actually talking about.
Yeah. I see a question popped up about training, and training's going to depend on how far you're going to get into it and what depth, what sort of questions you want to try and answer. And I think actually a lot of the lung stuff that is not commonly done is some of the easiest stuff to do at this point. There's nothing, virtually anywhere you put the probe on the chest, you almost can't avoid seeing lung, because lung is almost everywhere unless you just go directly over the heart. But and the lung pathology, if there's no lung there and there's just empty space, it's, where'd the lung go? It's a pneumo, and the difference between a wet lung and a dry lung, so to speak, is pretty striking. You get all these things called comet tails going through the lung. So, the people who want you to take courses, well, they'd want you to take hours and hours of ultrasound physics and, know all the highly, every knob on a fancy machine. But to do the lung stuff, it's 5 minutes to learn how to do it. You turn on the machine, you pick up the right probe, you orient it on the chest, and it's not a lot of image optimization to do this. And a lot of Medicare gamers, this is a video game. There's some eye hand coordination with the joystick, or what I call the joystick or the transducer probe, and there's a few knobs that you might sharpen up your image with, your gain, which is your brightness on your screen, and the depth to which you want to look, whether you want to look shallow or deep, and that's pretty much it. And it's just getting hands on and being able to make good enough images to make decisions. We're not going to have medics looking at things like, trying to play name that tumor from the, from the curly cues inside of a mass. There's basic questions that we're looking to have answered I call it quick and dirty ultrasound, and I do it in the ER, and I don't need to make a beautiful image that a 25-year sonology tech can make. You don't have to make a lung pretty. How do you make a pneumothorax look pretty? Well, you can bring up, make the muscles in the chest wall look more obvious if you want to make a really pretty image. But none of us cares about that. We're looking for what we need to get out of it, and there's just a lot of applications like that. One of the things that's being studied now for emergency department use is looking at the lining of your carotid artery. When you get vascular disease, it just isn't in your coronary arteries. It's all over the arteries all over your body. It starts out in. But you get symptoms because your heart doesn't take kindly to it, one, and two, the diameter of your coronary arteries is much smaller than the arteries in the rest of your body. But if you look at your carotid artery in your neck and you see disease in it, there's likely to be disease in your coronary arteries. The flip side is also true. If you've got very clean looking blood vessels in your carotids, it becomes highly unlikely that you have coronary artery disease. So what's that mean to the medic in the street? Well, we all get these people with BS type of chest pain, and they're hard to sort out. You think, because, X number of patients are going to have atypical symptoms. And, every so often you're going to bring the person in who you think's hysterical, hyperventilating, having an anxiety attack, and they're really having the big one. Obviously the 12-lead can help you out with that. But that's only if they're having an obvious MI on the cardiogram. But, you know, you're sitting out there in the field, well, you know, do I really want to give this guy aspirin? Do I give him nitro for this chest pain? You know, this is a goofy story. Well, if you put this on his neck and see that he's got extensive vascular disease, well, then you got to take him a whole lot more seriously, because there's a significant incidence of atypical, you know, chest pain, chest symptoms with coronary syndromes. Likewise, if they've got pristine looking blood vessels, the odds are very low that their chest pain is going to be due to coronary disease. Now, they could have another serious chest problem. They could still have a PE. They could have a pneumo. They could have something else causing their chest pain and their problems. But you know what? Then you're moving away from aspirin and nitro and looking at doing something else with that patient. So that's a little slightly more involved exam to do, but it's not terribly difficult. And I've taught medics how to generally look for the stuff and seeing disease in 5 or 10 minutes that, you know, some of the local, I've done a little bit of local teaching with our medics, just to get them interested. And, you know, it's like I said, it's like doing a video game, and they're able to pick up on it in 5 or 10 minutes and see people who, you know, they can pick out people who've, if you will, got the disease, and, you know, who's got good looking vessels and who's been doing a few too many bad things for too many years and got some mileage on board.
Dr. Prater, how about the other portion of the ultrasound that we're working on, where instead of all the knobology, you can just pick small, medium, or large-sized persons with all your preset defaults, and you're ready to go?
That's part of it. You know, part of one of the good things about the technology is having auto-focusing software and picking out preset parameters of what type of tissue you're looking at is, and that way not having to do so much pneumology. You can pick out preset depths, but, you know, changing depth on a patient and looking deeper or more shallow isn't real difficult. You know, obviously you want to get your whatever you're looking at as big as possible on your screen so that you can get a better look at things. But like I said, you know, for most of the stuff that we'd anticipate getting people's feet wet, quick and dirty is going to be fine. You're looking at yes, no type of stuff, not name that tumor sort of stuff.
You know, we've been talking about so much and we've had a lot of good questions. We had one question pop up, and I think as we kind of wrap things up, one of the questions that came up was, we're looking to get this in your area. How can somebody who's looking to maybe bring this technology in, maybe participate in a field study, how can they get more information on the equipment, on participating in some additional studies and research, and seeing how this would work in their community?
Well, it would have to be probably in most locations an integrated approach that both, you know, your service and medical direction would need to get on board. Sadly, not all emergency physicians are doing this clinically, and so, you know, hopefully you have a nearby department that your emergency physicians are progressive in doing this and are comfortable with ultrasound, because, you know, if you start transmitting them images of stuff that they have no idea what's going on, that's not going to be helpful. Or if you can prod them into doing this sort of thing, it would be helpful. We're going to be moving forward and hopefully getting some support and getting some units out there and doing some field trials. The first of these we'll be doing here in Pittsburgh and doing, you know, limited scope, limited question type things. And then we if our initial results are feasible and show feasibility to this, then either moving out to multi-center trials or if services are interested in hopping on the technology, that we would be happy to help them get started. But I would say it is probably going to be important to have physician buy-in too, with regard to your medical director, to move forward with this in most locations. But I'm happy to, if anyone, is interested in dropping me a line or an email, you can email me at braderhome@AOL.com, braderhome@AOL.com, and I'm happy to answer questions and take any sort of interest in moving forward with this.
And if you can't reach Eric, you can reach me. I think Jamie knows how to reach me too, and you got my email, Jamie, which can post up there if you want as well.
Okay. We'll definitely do that. So I guess as we kind of wind down, we're kind of about 10 minutes or so left. I'm looking in the chat room if anybody has any further questions or comments, and throw them out there. We'll see if we can squeeze them in. But are there any final thoughts about moving forward? What are we looking forward to? Or any final thoughts about ultrasound and its uses and applications?
I think looking at this is that the initial breakthrough points will probably occur in response vehicles, just from the price of it and getting expertise. The medic who's on response vehicles is hopping all the bad calls, and on helicopters too. Due to the difficulties in assessing patients in the helicopters, particularly in prolonged flights or in air transport medicine, where you're you could be picking up a patient overseas, you've got no X-ray, you've got no imaging capabilities in a medical transport situation. That I think those are probably the first areas to penetrate and. As things become more accepted, probably the price comes down with just like anything else, and it'll become more and more accepted with regard to medics. And the more remote you are, too, as far as being a medic, the more important it is to start the right decisions. So I think if you're in a short transport system, there's going to be fewer indications for it. The longer the transport system that you're in, and the more time that you're in the back of the truck with the patient, the more times you got to make the right decision. You're not going to get bailed out in 2 minutes. I can see even more utility for those services. So that's how I see it moving forward. And I could see I would hope we see reimbursement for it if you're going to the trouble of having these machines and doing the training and making the commitment and being able to give better care for your patients. I would hope that the reimbursement for doing that is reflective of that commitment.
Also, Eric, too, I was also thinking too, like advanced care paramedics that work on like maritime or oil rigs, and as you had mentioned, remote areas where they may not even see a helicopter for days or any aero medical transport for days. So they may have to do serial ultrasound exams and maybe potentially keep sending images to potentially keep treating somebody.
I want to thank you, Dr. Brader, for joining us, and Brian for really being an advocate for this and bringing it to my attention, and for helping me to bring Dr. Brader here on the show today. It's really, I think, important for us to continue to develop and to move forward and to look at ways that technology can help us. And we've seen things get smaller and more compact, and the price has come down all kinds of equipment that we have in the ambulance, and there's no reason to think that sometime in the future, as the prices continue to drop on everything, that we'll see more and more use of ultrasounds, even in services that may not have a long transport time or necessarily a huge amount of use for it. But certainly in the near term, we're looking, I think, at seeing this being used, like you said, in the military situations, in long transport times. And Dr. Brader, you talked several times about aeromedical transport and the necessity to have an assessment tool that doesn't require you to use your ears. So I think that this is this exciting technology. And I want to thank you both for bringing it to our attention.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie, for the opportunity to come on the show for the second time. And probably Dr. Brader and I probably would like to come back, I guess, when Dr. Brader, when you've got some more data on the pneumo study and stuff going on at Allegheny.
Yeah, that'd be we hopefully get up and get started that next couple of weeks. And there's actually just one study presented at the ASAP scientific meeting with regard to medics and inner facility transports of patients. There was just brief training, and there was excellent retention and detection of pneumothoraces that weren't even suspected on patients being transported. And so to a certain extent, that study validated this concept, but we want to do it with a machine out there in the field with scene runs, not just center facility, and see what we come up with.
Yeah, and just in closing, Dr. Brader and Jamie, we never really actually got into diagnosing AAA's, abdominal aortic aneurysms, which are probably one of the easiest things that we can see on fast exams with it, but we can do that another time.
Oh, there's a whole lot of information I'm sure we could jump into here, and you both are welcome to come back anytime if there's any kind of breakthroughs or information you'd like to share, either on an interview segment on the regular weekly show or on a Medicast Live like this one. We would certainly love to have you back. So that was our segment tonight. We recorded it and got it all squared away, and I hope you've enjoyed this discussion of ultrasound and EMS. I want to remind you there's links to follow up on some of the information that they provided us in the show notes, and you'll find those links over at medicast.com/blog. Click on the show notes button right there at the top of the page, and you'll be able to find the show notes links for this and every other episode there. Also, don't forget to send me your comments, questions, suggestions. If you want to get a hold of Brian or of Dr. Brader, you can certainly send me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Let me know what you think about this episode, or even share those comments directly over at the MedicCast site at medicast.com/blog. Click on the comments link right there and share your thoughts about this or any other episode or article over there. You can call in on the voicemail line, too. That number is 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. We'll get you through to our voicemail line here at the MedicCast. And you can always get in touch with us that way or by email, podmedic@mac.com. That's it for me. I want to remind you and close out, as I always do, that I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. And please, folks, stay safe. Keep yourselves handy to be back again next week listening to the show and back out there on the streets, and most importantly, back with your families. And to do that, you need to keep two things in mind: scene safety, BSI.